For the last couple of decades, we've basically been sold this idea of the digital world as a limitless highway. You jump in, hit the gas, and there's just this endless horizon of storage and compute power.
Right, the whole infinite cloud concept.
Exactly. It's all in the cloud, which sounds completely weightless, like it doesn't take up a single inch of physical space in the real world.
But it very much does.
It really does. And if you look at the raw data crossing our desks right now, that highway is suddenly running out of pavement. Welcome to today's deep dive. We are looking at a huge stack of sources from the Tech and AI Daily Dispatch for Thursday, April 9th, 2026. Okay, let's unpack this because beneath all these seemingly random updates, there is a massive collision happening.
There really is. It's structural.
Yeah, it's this friction between massive tech scaling and a sudden, fierce push for individual user control.
I'd say it is the defining tension in the industry today. And for you listening, our mission here is to map out exactly where this hyperscaling is hitting its limits.
Which is happening fast.
Oh, incredibly fast. We're talking physically, financially, and digitally. We are analyzing how both developers on the bleeding edge and everyday users are engineering some highly specific ways to fight back and maintain their autonomy.
Let's start with the physical wall, because before an AI can, write a sonnet or generate a bunch of code, it needs raw physical power.
Right, electricity.
Yeah, and that infrastructure is suddenly getting blocked. Maine is currently advancing legislation to become the first U.S. state to outright ban large new data center construction.
Wow. And the specifics of that Maine legislation are really telling.
Because it's not just a protest, right?
Exactly. This isn't just a generic environmental protest. Grid operators ran the math and realized that a single modern hyperscale AI data center can consume as much power as a small city.
That's insane. Just one data center.
Just one. And when you factor in the cooling requirements, I mean, we're talking millions of gallons of water or these massive HVAC systems, adding that to Maine's existing grid threatens to actively destabilize power delivery during their peak winter months.
So it's not a cloud at all. It's a heavy industrial furnace. It feels like trying to build a fleet of high-speed bullet trains only to realize your tracks are made of wood and they're just catching fire.
That's a good way to put it.
So how does this bottleneck impact the AI boom? Because every major player is promising larger and larger models.
It forces a brutal pivot. You have to move from sprawl to efficiency.
Yeah.
You cannot brute force your way to AGI if the physical power grid just denies you the electricity.
Right, the state literally says no.
Exactly. Regulatory precedents like Maine's have a way of spreading. So big tech companies now have to prove their AI investments actually generate a coherent return. They can't just act as endless energy-burning research projects anymore.
Which perfectly frames what Meta is doing right now. They just debuted a model called MuseSpark.
Yes, MuseSpark.
And what really caught my eye is that this is the first model released since Alexander Wang stepped in as their new chief AI officer.
Right, the Scale AI founder.
Exactly. For anyone unfamiliar, Wang is the founder of Scale AI. He is famous for absolute rigorous data discipline.
Bringing Wang into Meta was a highly calculated signal. He built his entire career on the premise that high-quality, meticulously labeled data beats raw, inefficient compute power.
Quality over quantity.
Precisely. When your data centers are facing legislative bans, you bring in someone like Wang to stop the bleeding.
He's there to trim the fat.
Yes. Notice that MuseSpark isn't just a generalized chatbot released into the wild for people to play with. It is highly targeted.
It's powering Meta AI's shopping mode, right?
Exactly. It's tied directly to revenue generation.
Yeah.
They are also promising an open source version of it, which, on the surface, looks like a gift to the developer community.
I have to challenge the altruism of that open source promise, though. If they are tightening their belts, releasing an open source model isn't a charity project, it's a trap, right?
Well, trap might be a strong word, but.
I mean, they want developers building on Meta's architecture so they don't migrate to Google or OpenAI.
That is the structural play. It is ecosystem capture. If Meta can make their highly efficient, Wang-optimized architecture the default standard that independent developers use, they control the foundation of the next web.
Even if they aren't running all the servers themselves.
Precisely. And this is a crucial signal for you to track as a listener. It shows whether Meta's AI push is finally gaining focus or if it's still scattered.
And independent developers are definitely looking for new foundations because the cost of interacting with these models is getting scrutinized heavily right now. The macro pressure on data centers is flowing right downhill to the individual builder.
He always says.
I want to look at this fascinating thread where a developer publicly documented abandoning their $100 a month subscription to Claude Code.
This was a masterclass in the new microeconomics of AI. What's fascinating here is how they approached it.
Yeah, they didn't just complain about the price online. They laid out the exact math. They dropped the flat subscription, moved to a highly optimized code editor called Zed, and routed their API calls through OpenRouter.
To understand why this matters, we have to look at how compute tokens actually work.
Let's break that down.
A token is essentially a piece of a word. It's the atomic unit of processing cost in a large language model. When you pay a flat $100 monthly fee, you are paying a massive premium for the interface and the convenience.
Regardless of how many tokens you actually use,
right.
It's the gym membership model. You pay $100 whether you go to the gym twice or 20 times a month.
Exactly.
But wait, isn't OpenRouter just adding a middleman? How does adding an API broker actually save you money?
Because OpenRouter acts as an automated programmatic switchboard. Instead of sending every single query to the absolute most expensive state-of-the-art model,
which is what the flat subscription does.
Right. OpenRouter can take your prompt and route it dynamically. If you just need a simple Python script formatted, it routes it to a model that costs fractions of a cent per million tokens.
Oh, wow. So it downgrades the engine for easy tasks?
Exactly. But if you need complex logic, it routes it to the premium model. This developer proved that by paying strictly for the tokens they consumed, routed intelligently, their cost dropped precipitously.
And their output speed increased.
Yes. Monitoring your Anthropic spend versus OpenRouter is a vital shift for anyone managing tech budgets right now.
So what does this all mean for how we actually work with these agents if we are trying to be hyper-efficient? They are managing every single token like it's a physical resource.
It's not just about finding cheaper models, though. It's about changing how the models actually think to reduce waste.
Right. Look at the new research from SkyPilot's engineering blog. They found that if you force an AI agent to thoroughly read and summarize its context before it starts writing code, the quality just skyrockets.
And the failure rate drops. The mechanics behind that are fascinating. It really comes down to how attention mechanisms work in transformer models.
Let's break that down for the listener. Why does reading first change the math so much?
When an AI generates text or code, it doesn't think holistically like a human does. It predicts the very next token based on all the tokens that came before it.
Which takes a lot of math.
It requires quadratic compute power. If the AI is trying to hold a chaotic, messy project brief in its attention while simultaneously calculating the exact syntax for a complex function, the computational load is immense.
And that's when it frequently hallucinates.
Yes.
It gets overwhelmed trying to hold too many variables in its head at once.
Basically, yes. But SkyPilot demonstrated that if you create a distinct, separate step where the AI only reads the messy data and outputs a clean, synthesized summary.
You create a new context vector.
A highly optimized context vector. So when the AI then moves to the actual coding phase, it's only looking at that clean summary. The next token prediction becomes vastly cheaper and way more accurate.
Which is highly relevant to how frameworks like OpenClaw approach multi-step agent work.
Exactly. It's a very intentional orchestration.
It makes perfect sense. It's like forcing an intern to write an outline and get it approved before they spend 3 days drafting a 50-page report. You are physically preventing them from wasting time and tokens.
And it puts the human firmly back in the driver's seat.
Which ties into our tool of the day, CSS Studio. I love this. You use it to lay out your website designs visually, by hand. You lock in the creative spatial choices yourself. Then you hand it to the AI just to generate the boilerplate CSS code.
It is a brilliant implementation of the human-in-the-loop philosophy. I mean, it's so much smarter than tools that try to own the whole creative process. AI is notoriously terrible at spatial reasoning.
Well, it's agonizing. You ask a standard chatbot for a button aligned to the right, and it gives you a floating red square in the middle of the screen, and you spend 2 hours arguing with it.
Because you are asking a statistical language model to understand geometry. It doesn't work. CSS Studio fixes this.
Right.
The developer does what the human brain evolved to do, spatial layout and creative vision. The AI does what a machine is good at, which is rapidly generating repetitive syntax.
The developer isn't surrendering control. They are weaponizing the AI's narrow strength.
Yes. proving developers are moving away from letting AI run wild.
But let's look at the dark side of that hyper-efficiency. If developers are building these incredibly cheap, fast AI pipelines, the sheer volume of synthetic output hitting the web is going to go parabolic.
It already is.
And as that floods the internet, our ability to verify what is real and trust the platforms we use is completely fracturing.
We are entering a severe trust deficit.
Mm.
And the technical solutions being offered by the tech giants are failing under scrutiny.
Right. Google has been pushing Synthide, which is their flagship AI watermarking system. The pitch was that it invisibly tags AI-generated output.
But a researcher just reverse engineered it.
Completely reverse engineered the Gemini Synthide system and published the crack on GitHub for literally anyone to use.
Which dismantles the core argument that AI companies can self-regulate their output.
If the biggest tech companies in the world can have their AI watermarks cracked and posted on GitHub, doesn't that mean watermarking is just a band-aid?
I would go further. It reinforces the case that AI watermarking is closer to security theater than a robust detection mechanism.
Let's explain how this watermark actually functions and why it broke so easily. Because, I mean, I always thought of a watermark like a transparent logo stamped on a photo.
Yeah.
But in text, it's purely statistical, right?
Correct. You obviously can't stamp a logo on a paragraph. Text watermarking works by subtly altering the probability of certain word choices.
Like how?
Imagine the AI is deciding between the words happy, joyful, and glad. The watermark system acts like a hidden tournament. It uses a pseudo-random cryptographic key to force the AI to pick the word glad slightly more often than it naturally would.
Okay.
If you know the key, you can span a document and see that statistical bias, proving a machine wrote it.
So how did the researcher crack that hidden key?
By analyzing enough output from the Gemini API, the researcher was able to spoof the system, observe the statistical shifts, and essentially work backward to deduce the pattern of the key. Once you have that, you can either strip the watermark out entirely, or worse, you could artificially apply it to something a human wrote.
It's like trying to watermark water. The moment you paraphrase the text or, you know, stir the water, the molecular structure changes and that delicate statistical pattern is just destroyed.
That is a perfect analogy. And it creates a false sense of trust. If a platform claims content is verified by Synthid, users lower their guard.
But if those tags can be stripped by anyone with a GitHub account, the system is actively dangerous.
Yes. And this technical erosion of trust isn't just happening at the code level. It is taking down major social institutions.
Trust is failing on massive social platforms, too.
Exactly. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, the EFF, just officially announced they are leaving X.
Which is a huge shift. And to be clear, and stick strictly to the facts of their announcement from the source, the EFF stated that their departure is due to the platform fundamentally drifting away from the principles it once claimed to defend. They basically determined that investing their resources into that specific ecosystem was no longer viable. We aren't endorsing either side of the politics there, just reporting what the EFF stated as their reason.
Of course. But think about the historical context here for the listener. For over a decade, the EFF used to go to bat for Twitter users. They fought legal battles to protect free expression and privacy specifically on that platform.
Yeah, they were a fixture there.
So their decision to walk away completely is a highly meaningful signal. When an institution with that kind of legacy decides the architecture of a massive public square is compromised, it shows where things stand regarding platform trust.
It confirms that the broader web is becoming increasingly chaotic. So let's step back and look at the environment we're navigating. The physical infrastructure is getting capped by states like Maine. Developers are rationing compute tokens. The flagship security tools from Google are broken on GitHub. And foundational institutions are fleeing the biggest communication platforms.
It's a lot.
When the public web becomes that fractured, what do you do?
Well, the natural human reaction is to retreat.
Mm-hmm.
You lock down the one piece of territory you actually can control, which is your own personal machine.
You fortify your local hardware, but the dispatch makes it clear that even our local operating systems are under attack. Look at this incredibly detailed breakdown of Microsoft's UI manipulations.
The dark patterns.
Right, dark patterns inside Windows. Here's where it gets really interesting, because while this isn't shocking, the thorough documentation shows the pattern is getting noticeably worse.
These patterns are engineered specifically to funnel users into paid OneDrive cloud storage subscriptions.
I want to be specific about what Microsoft is doing here, because it's not just a standard pop-up ad that you can click away from. They are actively obfuscating the user interface.
Yes, hiding the way out.
Exactly. They are hiding the decline buttons inside secondary menus. They are pre-checking consent boxes that are grayed out to blend into the background. And they're using warning language that implies your local hard drive will permanently lose data if you don't sync to their cloud.
It is the intentional weaponization of user anxiety. They are treating the user's local operating system as a hostile extraction zone for revenue.
Which is exactly why the open source community is fighting back with countermeasures.
Exactly. The privacy community is actively deploying defenses.
Which brings us to the release of Little Snitch for Linux. This is massive. Objective Development just dropped this port. It's the gold standard macOS network monitor finally landing on a desperately needed platform.
I cannot stress this enough to the listener.
Mm-hmm.
If you self-host or care about your machine silently phoning home, like Microsoft's UI tries to do, this is the most important privacy tool release in years.
Walk us through what it actually does under the hood, because it's not an antivirus program, right?
No, it operates at the kernel and network level. Usually when an application wants to send telemetry data back to a corporate server, it just reaches out and does it silently in the background.
You never even know.
Right. Little Snitch intercepts that packet request before it ever leaves your network interface. It pauses the connection and throws up an alert saying, this specific process is trying to connect to this specific IP address on this exact port. Do you allow it?
It makes the invisible completely visible.
Exactly. When you install a tool like this, the sheer volume of silent data extraction happening on a modern computer is staggering.
And Linux has needed a user-friendly, UI-driven tool for this for years. If you care about preventing the kind of telemetry extraction we just talked about, this is your dashboard. You have the power to sever the connection entirely.
And speaking of digital communications and severing connections to corporate servers, let's look at the Thunderbird situation.
Right, the open source email client. The Dispatch notes they are running an urgent donation campaign with real stakes.
An underfunded open source email client is a slow motion crisis for anyone who values actually owning their digital communications. This ties perfectly into our theme of control.
I was thinking about this. Almost every account you have, every password reset, every banking alert is tied to an email address. If Thunderbird goes under, what is the alternative for someone who wants to stay local? You are basically forced right back into proprietary web portals like Gmail or Outlook.
And when you do that, you surrender control of the protocol. Thunderbird operates on standard IMP and SMTP protocols. It pulls the raw data down to your local hard drive where you own it offline.
Right, it sits on your disk.
But when you use a corporate web client, your inbox is rendered on their servers, scanned for advertising data, and your storage limit is tied directly to the cloud subscriptions we just discussed with OneDrive. If you want autonomy, you have to financially sustain the infrastructure.
It's a constant effort to maintain control. But I want to end this section on a lighter note of reclaiming control. A victory that requires zero funding, just 5 minutes of your time.
Oh, the macOS trick.
Yes, this clean write-up going around on how to achieve truly instant space switching on macOS.
To defeat the dreaded animation lag.
It is infuriating. When you swipe to a different virtual desktop on a Mac, there is this mandated, unchangeable, half-second sliding animation.
Which Apple's design philosophy dictates is necessary to provide spatial context.
But power users don't need context. They need speed.
Mm-hmm.
If you are switching spaces 50 times an hour, it feels like the operating system is actively slowing down your brain.
Exactly.
For years, people have tried third-party hacks that always glitch out. But this developer documented a pure native approach that actually works. You don't need external software. You just go into your system settings, navigate to desktop and dock, and disable the toggle that says displays have separate spaces.
Good. Yeah.
Then you go into your accessibility settings and turn on reduce motion.
And combining those two native toggles interrupts the window compositor.
Yes, it kills the slide entirely. You hit the keyboard shortcut and the screen instantly cuts to the new desktop with zero latency. No terminal commands, no sketchy downloads. It is a tiny quality of life fix, but the psychological return on the 5 minutes it takes to set up is massive.
Because it is a localized reclamation of agency. You are forcing the machine to operate at the speed of your thought rather than the speed dictated by a corporate design team.
So let's briefly recap the journey for the listener today. We started by looking at the physical limits of the AI boom, with Maine stepping in to block the massive energy draw of data centers.
Right.
We watched developers pivot to radical efficiency, using open router token math and context agents to cut costs. We saw the illusion of verifiable AI shatter as Synthy Bow was cracked, and we tracked the user retreat to local hardware, fighting off dark patterns with network monitors and defending open source clients like Thunderbird.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we are watching a massive course correction. The era of blind trust in infinite cloud scaling and opaque AI is ending.
It really is.
It's being replaced by a demand for local control, measurable efficiency, and verifiable privacy. Users and developers are realizing that if they don't draw strict boundaries around their own environments, these systems will extract every available resource.
And here is a final thought to leave you with, based on that trajectory. If the hyperscale data centers face environmental bans, if AI watermarks completely fail to verify truth online, and if users actively lock down their personal machines using tools like LittleSnitch to sever telemetry and rely on local open source clients,
right,
could the ultimate destination of all this cutting-edge technology paradoxically force us back into an era that looks remarkably like the early 2000s?
A highly decentralized, fragmented web.
Exactly. Completely localized to your own hardware.
Yeah.
Fiercely private. And almost totally disconnected from the massive corporate cloud we were promised. Maybe that limitless highway was always destined to lead us right back to our own driveways. Something for you to mull over. Thank you for joining us for today's deep dive. Make sure you check out the dispatch, read the sources, and grab those privacy tools for your own machine. We'll see you next time.